This is just your quick reminder that as the panelists are speaking this afternoon, anytime you have a comment or a question that you'd like them to further explore later in the afternoon, write it on a card and give it to the table facilitator recorder. That way we'll be able to get ideas from lots of tables to take the discussion deeper. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists. Beth Lowry, Vice President, Environment, Energy, and Safety Policy, General Motors. John Bryson, retired Chairman and CEO, Edison International. John Milo, CEO, Amyris Biotechnologies. Nancy Keat, Director, Embark, the World Resources Institute. Vijay Vaitheeswaran, Global Correspondent, The Economist.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a tremendous pleasure and honor to be here today moderating a panel with such wonderful and extremely sharp experts. I also extend out a warm greeting to the audience on the live webcast, so many more eyes and ears are peering in and sending in their vibes and thoughts. So as is only appropriate in talking about this topic, we've all just enjoyed what I thought was an extraordinary plenary. That set the stage very nicely for our panel, one that talked about the moment in history when we have now crossed to being a primarily urban species and what challenges that poses. I think today we'll also speak about some of the solutions that are possible, made possible, if we do things right in, when we look at clean transport. But before we look to that future, and I turn to my panel, I thought I would take just a moment to reflect on a similar turning point a century ago. Winston Churchill, then a young First Lord of the Admiralty, which is something like the Secretary of Navy of Britain, decided as he saw the looming German threat before the World War I that the British Navy and its reliance on coal would not be able to handle the German threat. And he made a decision, which some considered rash, to embrace a fuel that was not even found on British shores. Petroleum. And naval historians say that decision gave the British Navy the speed, the maneuverability, and a decisive advantage in World War I. Some people say, as we enter this new century, that the century of oil is coming to a close, that momentous decision that Churchill took that set off a century of geopolitics, of economic prosperity related to oil and the internal combustion engine, but as well unintended consequences, environmental degradation, and the questions of congestion now pose a new challenge. We'll have a new American president shortly, one that will have to deal with climate change, with energy geopolitics. What will this mean for the automobile? What will it mean for the kinds of fuels that power transport? And is it a moment to reflect again and think anew to make another similar kind of change in direction? Let me start with someone who spends a lot of time thinking about these things at the World Resources Institute, Nancy Keat. Give us a little bit of a global perspective here. The panel set things up at lunchtime. We're entering an era of extraordinary urbanization. What's the opportunity here within that challenge?
Thanks, Vijay, and good afternoon, everyone. My task has been made a lot easier by the panel this afternoon and even a little bit by the panel this morning with some of the comments from Mayor Newsom. But just to repeat what people have been saying, we really are in the era of the city. So this 21st century is, or let me put it this way, sustainable development in the 21st century is largely about what's going to happen in cities. And I think everybody accepts that now. We have 3.3 billion people living in cities today, and that's going to head up to something like 6 billion by 2050. What I think is maybe not as well appreciated, in fact, I think the contrary view might be held by a lot of people, is that that's largely a good thing. And it's a good thing for the people, and it's a good thing for the planet, because cities concentrate all the energy and the creativity and the ambition, as well as the money, and the environmental footprint of humanity. Because people think that, 3% of the land mass has 95% of the energy use and the natural resource use. But if you spread out all those people over the globe, the resource use and the energy use and the water use and the land use would be much more. So
that's,
I think but if save people more.
That's the vision.
Yeah.
But not, just to be the rude journalist asking the question, in practical terms, isn't the world heading towards a world of a billion cars? And, as China and India particularly enter mass market consumerism, people want all the good things that people in the West enjoy, the mobility, the cold beer, the hot showers, made possible by energy. But if they do it in the same kind of resource-intensive way that's been done in the past in the West, doesn't that lead to, particularly with transportation and cars, a real nightmare?
It would. And I don't think it's possible that we're going to head that way. So in developing countries today, maybe some of them, 8%, 10%, 20% of the people have cars, private cars today. So it's just not possible to imagine that all those cities, all those people in those cities are going to have private cars. So the only way this is sustainable is if we move to a world or an urban world where most people use transit or walk or bike. And that's what they do already. So the question is how we transition from sort of a poor urban environment to a wealthier urban environment where walking and transit are the most attractive alternatives. And we have a couple of good examples in the rich world, like New York City and London and Paris. So how do we help the developing country cities want to be like and imagine that they can be like those three cities instead of the chaos of some of the big cities that we think about in developing countries? And we've got good examples in developing countries as well.
Let's hold that thought there, because I'm certain that Beth Lowry of GM has some views on the future of the car, but we'll get to that in a moment. Let me ask John Mello. John, your company is a pioneer in renewable biofuels. Can you see a way out of this dilemma that I've posed, maybe an artificial dilemma, but nevertheless, one in which a choice of fuels, the way that Churchill made a choice of fuels, might provide at least a relief valve, one part of the portfolio of the mix that we need? And what's your perspective? Again, working on advanced technologies, is this something that fuels can help address in a significant way?
I think it can. I think it can be part of the solution, not the total solution. If you think about the challenge we face, in transportation fuels today, we consume 500 to 600 billion gallons a year throughout the world. The growth in that consumption just between now and 2020 is 90 billion new gallons of consumption. If you think about those numbers, the scale of that is such that it's very difficult for any one solution to address that. So my view is it will be a mix of solutions, but those solutions have to be able to scale, which means they have to be sustainable, both environmentally and economically. They can't be solutions that depend on subsidies as a way to compete with alternatives. And they can't be solutions.
You heard it here first. A renewables manufacturer says no to subsidies.
At least not subsidies that try to. We are in a day where political statements can be made, right? I do think that long term, they have to be sustainable on their own, and they have to be scalable from an environmental perspective also. So I do think it can be part of the mix. It needs a significant commitment. It is a choice, and it needs to be compatible, or what I like to call no compromise, to the current alternative.
Let me turn to John Bryson. John, Edison, the utility based in Southern California, has been a world pioneer in another kind of transport fuel, electricity. Of course, it's a power utility, but has long experience in working with various forms of electrified transport, plug-in cars, and so on. I wondered, give us your perspective as that as a potential contender, and is that the right way even to think about this problem?
I think it's a good way to think about it.
Your microphone?
Oh, I'm sorry. We've been working at Southern California Edison for 20 years, full-time staff, lots of things, putting in infrastructure. And to say that we were ahead of our time was vast, vast understatement. So we lost some money and we made some mistakes early on, but it feels like this is the cusp, that there's a major, major swing. All of you read the newspapers, all of you care, you wouldn't be here. You know that substantially every major automobile manufacturer not just in the Western world, in the world, is now focused on the development of electric transportation. And I agree there are lots of alternatives, there are lots of choices. There'll be a lot to be sorted out between now and then on transportation fuels, but electricity has enormous advantages, and it can go ahead right now. So one of the ways to think about electricity as a transportation fuel is that you substantially today have the infrastructure in place. So I think a lot, people that I work with think a lot about tweaks in the infrastructure, and I can talk about a few of those if that arises in the course of the panel. But fundamentally, the U.S. electric system, around the world, the national electric systems, are a national asset. And, for example, maybe you know that DOE has done these studies. You could displace right now 70-some percent of the automobiles and trucks, the light-duty trucks, on the roads in the U.S., substitute on the basis of the existing electric grid, existing generation mix. So no meaningful additional infrastructure development. So it's a big advantage. It can happen right now. Another thing that people ask about, and I'll stop here right now because of the shortage of time, is, well, what about the electric system today, relative dirty generation system? Is there advantage in moving electricity today? And the answer is absolutely, because the system as it exists today, still in all, is vastly better controlled than internal combustion engines fired by oil. When I get a chance, I'll talk about the visit I've just made to China, but I'll
start here. Sure. And, of course, and on your point about plugging in today, the advantage or the attraction of electricity is that as the grid decarbonizes, as it must if we're to tackle climate change, the attractiveness of that particular fuel energy carrier only becomes greater. So that's
no question. But even let me just give this statistic. We and many others supported a study done by EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, and by the Natural Resources Defense Council. And that study, for conservative reasons, took the view, let's not assume a major change in the generation mix in the U.S. over the next 30 years. So assume no clean coal, assume not a major introduction of renewables. All of us believe, I certainly believe, our company believes, we've done more renewables than any utility in the United States, that those changes will take place. But even in the absence of those changes, just today, if there was widespread, meaning slightly more than 50% introduction of electric vehicles in the U.S., with the existing generation mix in the U.S., you would reduce carbon emissions, CO2, greenhouse gas emissions from automobiles and trucks by the equivalent of removing one-third of the vehicles on the roads today. So it can only get better and will decisively get better from this point forward.
We'll talk about some of the challenges and obstacles that remain when we get further down the conversation. But I want to turn to Beth Lowry of General Motors. President Clinton has been very kind to several book authors during this conference. In a shameless plug for Zoom, the global race to fuel the car of the future, written by yours truly, I put forward the argument, quite controversially, that fuels are we've focused on fuels, what comes after oil. But the idea, in fact, the big idea in getting over the chicken and egg problem in cars has been actually the electrification of the vehicle, the transformation of the automobile from one that's a 100-year-old nexus of gasoline and the internal combustion engine to a much smarter kind of innovative vehicle. That transformation GM is at the forefront of with vehicles we're going to hear about in a moment. But it's an idea that is, I think, quite controversial, the idea that transforming the automobile to be the platform for whatever fuel may come can be the potential. Is it possible for an industry, I think your company celebrates 100th anniversary this year, to transform the jalopy to make the juice work?
You got to love BJ, don't you? And I do think for the cleanup it's great because I think this is a time for us to be looking for solutions, and that's what this whole forum is about, is looking for solutions. And General Motors is at the forefront, which is at a very exciting time for us. We did just celebrate our 100th anniversary. And we're talking about reinventing the automobile along with reinventing the company. So the fact that we're talking about biofuels and next generation of fuels, so talking about electricity, talking about vehicles that General Motors can produce that will have a whole diversity of energy sources is a very exciting time. And I think what's best about the work that we've done with the Chevy Volt, for example, is the fact that we've met a lot with EPRI and all of the utilities and working with a number of stakeholders, including many of you in the room, and the grid can handle electric vehicles. It can handle plug-in vehicles. So we're doing our part with respect to the engineering to get those kind of vehicles on the road, along with, obviously, flex fuel vehicles and hybrids and clean diesels and doing everything we can with today's vehicles that everybody knows. And we have to all work together. So the point is the vehicle manufacturers will do their part. We need to have the utility and energy companies do their part. And we need, obviously, consumers to have a pull for those vehicles. And we need government to get sound policy in place.
Well, you've said a mouthful there, Beth. If I can push on one part of this. You know, when we talk about a world in which there may be multiple fuels, a portfolio approach, from the perspective of society, from the perspective of, say, venture capital, wanting to not put bets on any one technology winner, which has been a traditional fallacy in thinking about energy technologies, that poses a real dilemma for companies like yours, doesn't it? Because what if you bet on the wrong horse? Now, in-house, at a moment of uncertainty and change, how are you making your own investment decisions when confronted with rival alternatives that both sound pretty good, and an outside argument saying, actually, maybe we need to rethink the whole paradigm of the car. How do you decide how to place your bets?
Well, what we like to do is, right now, we're 96% dependent on petroleum. We do not think that's a very good strategy for the environment, for energy, global security issues. And so for a business, it's not a very good strategy either. So we have an energy diversity portfolio, so we can't bet on one. I get asked that question all the time. Our life would be a lot easier if there was one single solution and everybody invested from venture capital to government policy to what we spend our time and money on. So we have to play in all these areas. And the reason why we're doing that as well is depends on the resources around the world. So we do hope that transportation grows around the world, that we do it in a sustainable way. And in order to do that, you have to really capitalize on what the various resources are around the world. So there won't be a single solution just in one place.
I want to turn to Nancy and John to talk a little bit about work you've done in Brazil. Both of your organizations have made either new or ongoing commitments. But as I do, I want to draw from Beth's organization an ongoing commitment they made to expand dramatically the fleet of flex fuel vehicles, something that has, will allow cars to run on multiple fuels. But the point I want to take to Brazil is to ask Nancy this question, the potential for leapfrogging in developing countries. In America, of course, is the pioneer in many realms, biotech, IT, and so on. But when it comes to energy, in this case, automotive technology, Brazil actually led the world with flex fuel technology, including GM's own division there, as well as other American companies, before it became meaningfully present in the American marketplace. What can we learn, and can you tell us a little bit about your ongoing commitment there? And I'd like to see if I can strike a deal, broker a CGI partnership on stage with John, just giving him a little warning of that.
Okay, good. Well, the Embark commitment with Brazil from a few years ago was with the city of Porto Alegre and our main funder, which is the Shell Foundation. And we committed that we would help the mayor of Porto Alegre make a bus rapid transit system. And this has been, the planning's completed and everything's lined up, but it's a little bit stuck, partially due to prior capital commitments from the previous mayor and partially due to Brazilian politics. So it's all ready to go. The elections are this year. Either that mayor is reelected and he'll go with it, or we're trying to work with the other candidates and hopefully they will implement it, and then we'll see if that comes through. What John Mello and I have been talking about is John's company, that he didn't get a chance to say this, is developing either is underway or is working on developing biodiesel from sugarcane, which is really exciting to us. And Brazil has a commitment to have 5% of biodiesel in their fleet. So we think that should go into fleets, and what's better to put them in than bus fleets. So we're also at present working with all the levels of government in Brazil to try to help them get ready for the 2014 hosting of World Cup football, trying to get all the cities ready. And they're going to have tremendous opportunities for all you institutional investors out there for investment in the transit corridors they need and the real estate along it. And then we want to try to pull in John's biodiesel into the bus fleets. And that's what we're talking about.
John, you've got a promising new commitment, new technology. You're working in a place where the sugarcane ethanol is recognized to be environmentally and in terms of life cycle analysis superior to the way we do it here in the U.S., certainly with corn. Are you ready to take the leap?
Absolutely. We are, you know, we have two commitments, right? We have this new partnership that we'd like to commit to, which is really to fuel the fleet of buses in the cities that will be participating in the 2014 World Cup with renewable diesel. Not a biodiesel, but a renewable diesel, a diesel made from sugarcane, a diesel that has as good of an energy content as petroleum-based diesel, and a diesel that reduces CO2 by at least 80% from petroleum and reduces NOx by over 10%, and a diesel that works in the current infrastructure without change. And that's what I mean by no compromise. No,
that's a big deal, folks.
I think... To participate at scale, we can't require infrastructure to change significantly. It has to start with, it has to play in current infrastructure, and it has to be right for the environment. So under that basis, we would love to help.
Please.
Just one thing to come back, because, you know, I work with bus drivers. It has to be easy for bus drivers, too, which is why the no compromise is so important. You know, these guys don't have big margins. So the business model has to really work for them, and this is, you know, really attractive.
That's great. Well, I will follow up on that to be sure. There'll be David and his team will follow up. But I appreciate your willingness to be put on the spot. The question of leapfrogging, though, I want to pick the Brazil's a great example. You can see the kind of things happening with the two folks on the panel. But China is another place where there's extraordinary problems, of course, but also opportunity and the reality of leapfrogging. I know, John, you've been there recently. And China, its work on advanced electric automobiles, the potential for taking a different path. When we look at the energy infrastructure that's going to be in place, the automobiles or other transit in 2050, in OECD countries, which are mostly built out, it's going to require dealing with legacy assets. But when you look at a place like China that's building cities and power plants over time, most of that has not yet happened, and they could take a very different course. So give us a little flavor of what you've learned and what you think the potential is for developing countries to teach a developed world a thing or two.
This trip to China was so you announced me as retired. This is the first time I've been announced in a public setting as retired. It's true. But it's a new world, and I decided the thing I wanted to do was go off to China. And I spent some of the time looking at just this question, fuel transport and electrification and development of electric vehicles in China, and the work is stunning. It's part of the global change that we know about. It's part of the extraordinary, extraordinary energy, talent, commitment of China to begin to lead the world in many, many areas, and this would be among them. So just a snapshot of that, China is putting in this breathtaking infrastructure. I went way west. I went to about as far west in China as you're likely to go for other reasons. I wanted to see some art things there. But, you know, you have 4- and 5-lane freeways everywhere in China. So it's not that the car won't be part of it, but the infrastructure in the major cities with mass transit is also stunning. On the specific point of electric vehicles, as most of you know, the biggest single challenge is battery development. So enhanced energy density, efficiency, acceleration is usually there. That tends to not be a problem. Capacity, life cycle, weight, costs, and extraordinary work is being undertaken in China right now. I'm not saying it's stronger than anywhere else in the world, but the commitment is very strong. And I met, for example, with the man who heads, he is a party secretary. He is responsible across China for recommending to the federal leadership in China the total China automobile policy. Electric transportation is a key component of it. Battery development is a key component of that. And there's an entity in China called Lishan, and I spent a day with these people. They're doing extraordinary.
Let me stop you there, because this point, I mean, it's clear you're persuaded that there's a real opportunity there and they're serious about it. I want to turn to Beth, because the point about batteries, this is one of the linchpins in thinking about the energy future, along with the grid, of course, which has been rightly emphasized, development of a smart grid. But energy storage can be transformative for renewables, but especially for vehicles like the Volt that you're developing. Can you give us a realistic assessment in real time? How big a risk is it to your development program for the Volt and related vehicles, and what advances are being made?
Well, the battery is a major challenge. As John mentioned, a lot of the development work is going on in Asia, in Korea, Japan, China. And so we're working very hard with suppliers. We have a couple suppliers for the Chevy Volt. So far, everything looks very, very good. We've met all the milestones. We have what we call mules running around our proving grounds. So we're very, very optimistic that we'll be able to make it. But certainly there are the durability, quality issues. We put a whole new battery center in place to make sure we can get those testing mechanisms done quicker than normal in a product development cycle. So we're very optimistic at this point. We've had a lot of discussions with the U.S. government on how important it is to make sure we have the capability on batteries from a manufacturing and research and development here in the U.S. And as you can imagine, we spend a lot of time in China as well. We put together an energy center there to really understand all the different fuels, including electrification of the vehicle. Had some very promising discussions with them with respect to hydrogen and fuel cells. Fuel cells are also electric vehicles. So a lot of the developing countries have an opportunity to really leapfrog from an infrastructure standpoint.
What could happen? And this is a question both for you and for Nancy. With something like the Tata Nano, of course, Tata being India's largest conglomerate, despite some initial hiccups they're having in getting a factory started in Bengal, there is the potential for Clay Christensen has called disruptive innovation here, a fundamentally different model, cheap and cheerful, the way that the PC disrupted the mainframe model. The analogies come fast and plentiful in the business school literature. In real life, you're the dinosaur that's going to be disrupted if this happens.
Actually, we don't think of us as being a dinosaur. We certainly as high-tech a company as many other companies.
You might be the dinosaur that learned how to dance. but, you know, what is the, you know, in market terms, how seriously do you take the threat?
Well, I think it's a very serious issue with respect to affordable transportation for the developing markets. And General Motors is already have joint ventures in China with small affordable vehicles, so the Nano got a lot of attention, but certainly there's a lot of development going on in other places as well. So if that breaks through the market, I think GM will be a leader in that as well. What we really need to do is really understand all the issues surrounding transportation, and that includes all the market, the resources, and making sure we develop mobility in a sustainable way.
And the sustainability point, Nancy, what happens if we do have these vehicles which proliferate? Again, we're heading towards a world of a billion cars, and it won't be that long before we pass further thresholds. And what does that do for your vision of sustainable mobility?
Well, you know, everybody, a lot of the environmentalists really tried to vilify Tatas when they introduced the Nano. It would be the end of Indian cities. And I just couldn't see it that way, because what it's a substitute for are a lot of two-wheelers and some three-wheelers, which are pretty dangerous. Whole families ride on two-wheelers in Indian cities, so I could see.
And they have those nasty two-stroke engines, which are very dirty.
Yeah, although those are being changed out. But so I went to see the Tatas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing that they're interested in is getting into this bus rapid transit business, and that's all sort of on hold as they're trying to get their factory opened in West Bengal. So it will have to be a mix. We're going to have to wind up with a mix of transit, and as I've said before, you're really going to have a transit-dominated urban system. And then there'll always be some private cars, and I hope that we see a lot of private car sharing and things like that. But I want to put out an example that I think will surprise people, although maybe the mayor of Seoul was here another year and your audience might know about
it. Quickly, though, because we're okay.
Cities, there are cities around the world that are ripping up highways because they find that the city is more livable without it, and they can handle the traffic that they have better without the highways. So Seoul ripped out a major urban highway, and they found that the whole city cooled down 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, and the city was much more livable. So I don't want you to walk away thinking we have to build more highways because more cars are inevitable and we have to accommodate more cars. It's not the trend. San Francisco's ripped out a downtown highway. Mexico City's building more mass transit instead of more highways. It's, you know, there's a not, you don't have to accommodate more and more cars. And I think that cities are thinking about this in a different way, and it doesn't have to be, you know, more cars, more highway, more flyover.
And I know that Mayor Bloomberg was on the earlier panel. He would certainly have views on this. There must be some role, I would argue, for congestion charging and some of the tools, common sense tools of economics, to be applied to managing the congestion of the future. Although it was, of course, difficult to do in New York City. We're a very ornery city, and people value their ability to come and go. But to seeing mobility as certainly a right, and that's how people see it around the world. But it doesn't have to be free, especially when there's a public good that is metered and that can be measured, and where it works with everything from cell phone minutes to time on flying on airlines. People know how real-time pricing works, dynamic pricing works. We're going to stop our conversation for the moment now. We've come to the end of our initial discussion period, but you all know how it works. We're going to have a chance to discuss at your own tables, and we'll have a chance to respond to your questions after a few minutes.
Great. How about joining in a round of applause for a great panel? Thanks, VJ. So as VJ said, you know the drill. You all get a kick out of how much time we spend coming to the exact wording of these questions. In this one, we want you to focus on the next 5 years. So keep that in mind. In the next 5 years, what should be the top priorities to accelerate the transition to a clean transportation future? We know that's where we want to get, but in the interim, the next 5 years, what should be the top priorities to accelerate that transition? Enjoy. You'll again have 25 minutes this time.